All right, so we are in the second parak. Parak Bet Pasuk Chaf Bet, I think. Chapter 2, 22. That sounds right. The king has had a dream. He is frightened by the dream. He summons all of the advisors and he says to them, "You better tell me what it was that I dreamed and what it meant, or off with your, well, not just off with your head, but cutting them up into small pieces as discussed." The advisors say to him, "There's no way. We can't possibly explain, you know, a dream that you won't even tell us what it is." Rasajagon is of the belief that he's testing them, that he actually remembers what the dream is. Everybody else seems to assume, no, he has no idea what he dreamed. He only knows that he is scared. The Chaldeans, the ones who are sort of his people, they try to speak to him in Aramaic, his own language, and so the book switches into Aramaic at that point. And they ask him for, you know, some kind of help in explaining it. He says to them, "I know you're just stalling for time, or buying time, as the expression goes." And he says, "Off with your heads. That's it. It's over. I'm starting to kill every sage in my kingdom." Daniel and his friends are summoned as part of that group. Daniel finds out what's going on. He says, "Wait, just, you know, let me turn to God. God is going to help me." He davens, and lo and behold, in a dream that night, he is told what it was that was in the dream and what it means. And he offers praise to Hashem, and the line from Kaddish, Yehi Shmei Rabba Mevarach, that line comes from the praise that he gives to Hashem in Pasuk Chaf in 20. And that brings us to, yes, Pasuk Chaf Aleph that we're up to, sentence 21. As part of Daniel's praise of Hashem, he says, "V'hum Hashnei Idanaya V'zimnaya." He says about God, that God is the one who alters, who changes times. Mahadei Malchin, he removes kings. Umahakim Malchin, and he appoints kings. And this is a message to Nebuchadnezzar, right? Nebuchadnezzar, you should just be aware. It's not only praise of God, but it's a statement about Nebuchadnezzar. God sets up kings and God removes kings. But it's also because that's going to affect the content of the dream in terms of what it was that Nebuchadnezzar actually saw. Yahiv Chachmasal HaChakimin, he gives wisdom to the wise. Umanda Aliyodei Vina, and he gives understanding to those who have understanding, to those who know. In other words, any intelligence, any perception that we have, from God. Hugale amikasa umisatrasa. He says, God reveals that which is deep and that which is hidden. Yada mavachashocha, he knows that which is in the darkness, that which is hidden by darkness. Unahare me shrei, and light resides with him. It's all within God's possession. And he concludes, Lach elaka avahasi, you, the God of my fathers, the God of my ancestors, Mahodeum Shabbat Ana, to you I thank and I praise, Ana Div Tichokmaso Gvurta Yahavt Li, because you gave me wisdom and you gave me strength, Uch Anhodatani Diva Enaminach, you have told me that which I asked of you, Di Milas Malka Hodatena, you have told me the word of the king. You've given me insight into the dream. Ibn Ezra notes that he threw in the middle there that God is the God of our ancestors, right? In Pasuk Chaf Gimel 23, he credited God as the God of our ancestors, as much as we do in our davening. We call God Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, the God of our ancestors. So Ibn Ezra explains why. If you take a look at source number one, Ibn Ezra writes, Ba'abur hayos avoseinu v'in, because our ancestors, my ancestors in the case of Daniel, were prophets, as opposed to the ancestors of other nations. In other words, I come from a tradition of prophecy, which when you think about it, you know, as a general rule, when you look at the religions that we are familiar with, usually there's sort of one prophet who conveyed everything to the nation, and that's it. Whereas Judaism has this concept of many prophets. How many? And the Gemara says that there were thousands upon thousands of them, but just the ones that we know, there are dozens of them. The ones named in the Gemara, there are I think it's 48 males and 7 women who are known as prophets by name in Tanakh. So he says, this is something that actually is part of our identity. It's not just there's one prophet God speaks to, but there are many. And that's what I'm appealing to God, you know, to provide for me as well. It's something that actually the Kuzari is very into. This idea of prophecy as the height of what a human being can achieve. It shouldn't be seen as something that is far off and only for, you know, someone in ancient history, but it's actually this idea of prophecy is stronger and more present within the life of the Jew. That's sort of that which a person should aspire to. So he says, that's what I used when I called upon God. Va'amar di ve'ena. And he says, that which I asked of God, hu v'chaverav. He and his colleagues, meaning Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, ka'omer lo bizchusi levadi hodatani zasod, as if to say, it's not only my merit, but it's also the merit of those around me who all davened for this. So Daniel says, it's not really me. Much like, if you remember, Yosef says, it's not really my merit that's causing me to understand the dreams. Clear? Okay, so we've had a lot of build-up. What was it? Pasuk Chav Dalet, sentence 24. Kol kavel dina. At this point, Daniel al Aryoch. Daniel goes to Aryoch, who we've already seen. Dimani malka lahobade hakime Babel. Aryoch was the one the king had appointed to destroy the sages of Babel. Azal, he went to him, v'chein amar lei, and he says to him the following, l'chakime Babel al tehoved, do not destroy the sages of Babel. Ha'eli kadam malka, bring me before the king, ufishra l'malka achave, and I will tell the king the meaning of his dream. Now, the truth is, we have a couple of different options here. I brought on the sheet a few sources just to talk a little bit about dreams overall, because the role they play in Tanakh and since is actually an important concept to talk about. On the other hand, people might be itching to get to, so what did Nebuchadnezzar dream already, and what was the explanation? So, your call. Talk about dreams a little bit as a framework, or go right into Nebuchadnezzar's dream? Okay. So, in terms of the way that we look at dreams and the role that they play in Tanakh and beyond, what's the difference between a dream and a prophecy? Think about it based on what you've seen in the Torah.
Isn't a dream a form of prophecy?
It's like a low-level prophecy.
A dream is a low-level of
Can be.
Prophecy. Can be. Is it always?
No, it could be something from your subconscious coming in.
Symbolizes something, like prophecy is more direct, like this is what will be, but there's not a lot of dreams, right? There's a lot of garbage in there, you have to pull it.
Well, I'm thinking even within Tanakh itself. How are dreams used?
It was from God, and the dream is something that someone had themselves.
Always?
But God uses dreams as a way to give Nebuah sometimes.
I mean, we certainly have dreams that are presented as being from God. God goes to Avimelech, right? When Avimelech is going to attack Yaakov and his family, Hashem comes to him, b'chalom halayla, in a dream of the night. But it's from God, and it's a direct message, too. It's not something vague and, you know, with a lot of stuff in it. It's, you know, it's substantive. If you take a look on your sheet, what you actually find is that there's a spectrum even within Tanakh itself. It's not as though it's clear cut. You have on the one end, I brought you a pasuk from Iyov. This is from Elihu, who gives sort of the last speech before God's speeches to Iyov. And one of Iyov's main complaints in the Sefer is that God doesn't communicate with human beings, that God doesn't tell them what's going on. So Elihu insists to Iyov that God does. He says, Ki be'achas yedaber kel, u'bishtayim lo yishurena. God will speak once, even twice, but man won't see it. We don't understand what it is we're seeing. Bachalom, in a dream. Chazion laila, a vision of the night. Binefol tar demala nashim, when sleep falls upon men. God sends dreams, and the dreams are communication. It's just that you don't realize what's going on. It sounds like a dream is prophetic. But then, take a look at number three. Number three is the message that Hashem gives to Miriam and Aharon when they've spoken as they've spoken about Moshe. So Hashem says to them, you guys got to know your place. You're not Moshe. Vayomer Shimunadva, right? He says, hear my words. Im yehyeh nevi achem. If you get a prophet among you at all, Hashem b'mara elav esvada. I, God, I make myself known in a vision. Bahalom adaber bo, in a dream, I'll speak to him. It is nevuah. In Yenu Biachem, we're talking prophecy. But God says it's a lower level, it's a dream level, suggesting that dreams do not have the same thing, but they do have something prophetic about them.
So I have a question then. Is it man's fault that are we not trying hard enough to understand what our dreams are, or are we not capable of it? And if we're not capable of it, then why is it happening? It's like...
Great. So, good question. Hold the question for a minute, and that's where I want to go with it.
Are you talking about our current dreams as well in this category, or our dreams in Tanakh?
Right now, Tanakh. Then I want to get to the question of what happens with us. If you take a look at number 4, you find Zechariah say, Ki'atrafim dibru aven v'akosmim chazu sheker v'chalamos hashav yedaberu. Hevel yinachemun. Zechariah says, dreams, they speak emptiness. There's nothing to them. So you have three different psukim, speaking of dreams in three different ways. So it's not a simple thing where in Tanakh dreams have meaning and post-Tanakh dreams do not have meaning. Even within Tanakh itself, there is a spectrum. In terms of the stories in Tanakh, you find a spectrum as well, but you do find a clear delineation in the sense that in order to be a Navi in Tanakh, you have to train for it. You actually have, they had schools for Nevi'im. The term in Tanakh is B'nei HaNevi'im, literally the sons of prophets, but what it means is student Nevi'im. That's what they were. They trained for prophecy. Prophecy, generally, Nevuah in Tanakh, tends to come through a messenger. There's somebody who speaks. A dream doesn't necessarily have a speaker. Right, Yosef has dreams and he sees sheaves and they're bowing down or stars surrounding the moon and the sun. There's no speaker, there's no voice telling him anything. Dreams tend to be a vision. Prophecy tends to be a message from somebody. Prophecy is either explicit or requires explanation. A dream can be entirely opaque, like the example we're going to see with Nebuchadnezzar. So that there are real differences between Nebuah and dreams. But dreams may be highly prophetic. They may have a real message to them. And they may have nothing of meaning or substance at all, like Zechariah says. And that then influences the way that we look at our dreams as well. The Gemara in Brachos is the primary place where this is discussed. I didn't go through the whole thing on here because I wouldn't have had room to put anything else on the source sheets. There's a very long Gemara in the 9th parak of Brachos that talks about dreams, because there, in that context, they're talking about different brachas and prayers for various odd occasions, and they talk about what one should say if they have a dream and they're scared. The practice that you may be familiar with, sorry?
Chalam tov.
Well, hatavas chalom, right? The term hatavas chalom is to make a dream good. That's the
idea. Plenty of some people say that.
And that's also, right, the practice of saying something when the Kohanim are duchening, when they do Birchas Kohanim. But the truth of the matter is that the Gemara is split on whether dreams should be taken seriously or not. The Gemara offers you multiple perspectives, and it brings stories to support each side of it. The primary dominant view in the Gemara is that however you interpret a dream, that's what's going to happen. Whatever you do with it, that's the way it's going to be. So that they even have this bizarre story involving someone by the name of Barhedya, who was a dream interpreter. And two Chachamim, I think it's Abaye and Rava, go to this Barhedya, and they each tell him that they had a dream, and it's the same dream that they report to him, but one of them pays him to explain it, and the other one doesn't. And the one who pays him, which I think was Rava, gets this positive, wonderful explanation. No matter how hideous the dream itself is, it's given a positive spin. And the one who doesn't pay him gets this horrible explanation, no matter what the substance of the dream was, and it's the same dream. And then the Gemara concludes, and both interpretations came true for each party. The way you explain it is going to influence what's actually going to happen to you. And that's sort of one school of thought in the Gemara, is that the explanation has meaning. Another school of thought in the Gemara is, no, dreams are completely and totally meaningless. They are simply a reflection of what you thought about during the day. That's all it is. The Gemara says it explicitly. They tell a story. The story happens twice. Once in the period of Shavuot Malka, who was a Persian prince, and once later, but both within the period of the Gemara, in which the prince comes to one of the sages, one of the Chachamim, I think the latter story is involving Rish Lakish, and says to him, I've heard that you Jews are supposed to be wise, so I want you to tell me what I'm going to dream about tonight. Shades of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Tell me what I'm going to dream this evening. And so in both cases, the Chacham tells him something basically the same, it's roughly the same, but basically you're going to be attacked by your enemies and they are going to torture you, and he has a dream that night, sure enough, about being tortured in this way by the enemy because he thought about it all day long. And so that's meant to indicate that, yeah, dreams are just, you know, detritus of the mind. It's whatever you were thinking about during the day and working itself out.
Well, like very often, like what it is that you're thinking about before you fall asleep is what it makes.
Yeah. So that's that really is a very strong statement in the Gemara. There's one line in the Gemara which says that dreams have within them 1/60th of nevuah, 1/60th of prophecy. Now, to you, does that mean that dreams are or are not prophetic? If you say it's 1/60th.
That's not prophetic.
No, there are two ways you can look at it. That's exactly right. There are two ways you can look at it. One way to look at it is 1/60th. That means there's prophecy there. The other way to look at it is no, 1/60th is, for, you know, that which we usually say is batel. It's nullified in the mix. That 1/60th is insignificant. So you have both
ways of looking at it. Can't you say that it's different, though? Like a chalom was part of Nibu, and Nibu existed, and now there's no more of that, so there's no more real chalom. So maybe you could say that there's something that you're getting the same way to see, like, kids have Nibu or a mother when she has a baby, but it's not real.
So one way to look at it is that it could be Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh is a step down from Nebuah. It's something that's more subtle and does not necessarily come with any sort of a clear message. And you could make the suggestion that it's Ruach HaKodesh. I mean, there are people who take it very, very seriously and do the Hatavas Chalom, like, very seriously. Like, if they have a frightening dream, they'll fast and they'll... You know, the Hatavas Chalom, for anyone who's not familiar with it, is where you tell somebody that you had this dream. You tell a group of three that you had this dream, and they all tell you, Chalma Tava Chalemus, you dreamt a good dream. Or in Hebrew, Chalom Tav Chalamta. And they'll say it to him three times, and they'll insist, don't worry, it's going to be a good dream. It should all be for the best. I had when I first started out in as a rabbi, actually, it was my year of internship. I entered in a shul that had a Sephardic minyan, and I used to rotate through their various minyanim. And so I davened at the Sephardic minyan. One Shabbos morning, a fellow comes up to me and says he had a horrible dream the night before and he wants to fast. Shabbos. Do you fast on Shabbos? So the halacha actually is in Shulchan Aruch. But yes, the person who is really disturbed by a dream, they're so frightened, does fast on Shabbos, and then they have to fast on Sunday to make up for having fasted on Shabbos. That's sort of the penalty that goes with it. They get to eat, let's say Shabbos is just a morning to evening fast, but they do fast on Shabbos. You fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush already Friday night, so you yotze the Del Reisa in that sense. And in terms of the enjoyment of Shabbos meals, well, the enjoyment that you're having from Shabbos meal is gone if you're so scared, thinking that something terrible is going to happen and you need to avert it and we're forcing you to eat instead. Your enjoyment of Shabbos will come by not eating, will come by fasting. So that's actually the halacha in Shulchan Aruch. I mean, I'm very hesitant to apply that for people, but in that case, I was an intern, so I just told him that's the rabbi. But it's in practice, one who was just miserable and probably needed would be allowed to, not because we believe the dream necessarily has meaning, but because this person is going to be miserable while Shabbos, they're not enjoying Shabbos anyway. This is their own egg. This is their enjoyment of Shabbos.
There are stories of people who have a dream three times. They ignore it, and they ignore it, and then they go, and then it really happens.
Yeah. There definitely are such stories, and even Ezra, in fact.
Even recently, yeah. I've heard some crazy things.
I believe it. I once gave a shiur on this in my shul on this issue, and afterwards a woman came to me and told me she had a story about how she dreamed about finding a dead bird in her closet, and then it turned out a certain relative had died. And, like, people have, you know, all sorts of stories. I had a dream that I dreamed the name that my brother and his wife were going to give to their child, but I think I was cheating because they named it for two grandparents who had passed away. I probably had some thought in advance about that. I don't think that it was like, wow, he dreamed that. I got the names in the backwards order, too.
Yeah, I was on here today, and the first day that I went to Calgary, I had, like, a terrible, terrible dream, and I didn't know anyone in Calgary, and I felt like I needed to, what is it called?
Hatavas Chalom.
Exactly. So I called you, Alan. She was working at Open Eye, and she put me on speaker with two people in the office, and we did it. So I was like really freaked out, and I literally didn't know a soul.
I mean, you could blame it on stress. You could blame it on stress of the move. You could, you know, whatever. But it's, Hatabas Chalom is harmless. And what you do with the Kohanim is also mostly harmless, you know.
I as well. I did it once also. I had three similar dreams that were very similar.
Yeah, no, people do it. And what I wanted to show is that within Tanakh itself, you have this spectrum of possibilities, whether a dream is meaningful or not. And when you get into the Gemara, they have the same spectrum. And it's really funny because really the image that you get coming out of the Gemara is dismiss it, ignore it. Even though we have Hatavas Chalom, it sounds like Gemara is not so concerned. And then Ibn Ezra, of all people, who really is a rationalist in so many different ways, comments himself that actually dreams, he said the Psak in the Gemara follows the view that dreams are meaningful. That you should assume there is nevuah within a dream. So there certainly is such a perspective. So that's just a little bit of background on dreams. This dream is going to be taken very seriously, as the Nebuchadnezzar is being told what's going to happen for centuries to come. So that's what we're going to see here. So let's see the dream. Pasuk Chavei. And Dayin Arioch behis Bahala Hanel Daniel Kadam Malka. So Arioch hastily brings Daniel up in front of the king, which is good because, you know, his job was to execute people, and I might have thought he just, you know, goes ahead with his job. But no, he brings Daniel in front of the king. V'chein Amar Lei. And so he said to the king, Dihashkechas Gevarmin B'nei Galusa Di Yehud. He found a guy, or there is found a guy from the exile of the Jews, the Fishrel Amalka Yehudia, or Yehuda, who will tell the king what the meaning of the dream is. Ani Malka Amar LeDaniel, Dishmei Belshazzar. So the king declares to Daniel, whose name is Belshazzar, because remember, that's the name that he's actually been given. Can you really tell me the dream I saw and its meaning? Because remember, Arioch only said, he'll tell you what it means. So Nebuchadnezzar thinks to himself, there's another one of those who says, tell me what I dreamed. No. I'm going to tell you, the king says, I want you to tell me what it was and what it means. So Ari Daniel Kadam Malka. Daniel declares in front of the king, Bahamar, and he said, Raza di Malka Sha'el, that which the king has asked, the secret. Lachakimin Ashfin Hartumin Gazrin Yachlan Lahachavaya Lamalka. None of the various sorcerers are able to say anything. They can't tell the king anything. Even as a class of sorcerer we didn't mention in the beginning of the paragraph, these Gazrin, people who make decrees. Baram Isai Elaka Vishmaya, but there is a God in heaven, Gale Razin, who reveal secrets. V'hoda l'malka Nebuchadnezzar, madi l'heve ba'achris yomaya. And he has revealed to Nebuchadnezzar that which is going to happen at the end of days. Chelmach v'chezve resha al mishkavach dinahu. This is what you dreamed and what you saw in your head while you were lying on your bed. Note, by the way, he says, Elaka, right? In Pasuk Chavchet, in sentence 28, he says, one God. If you flip back for a second to Pasuk Yid Aleph, you find that the Chaldeans, the Kazdim, referred to Elohim, gods. In other words, Daniel is not just crediting Hashem, but he's making a theological statement. Not gods, God. And so he says, here we go. Pasuk Chavches. Ant Malka Rayonach Amishkavach Siliku. You, O king, your thoughts, while you were sleeping, traveled. Madi Lehevei Achrei Dina, in terms of what is going to happen after this. Vagale Razaya Hodach Madi Lehevei, and the revealer of secrets informed you what is going to happen in the future. Daniel tells him, this is what you were thinking about, and this is where it went. That doesn't mean that he's saying it's meaningless and only a function of your thoughts, but what he is saying, and Abarbanel makes this point in the fifth source that I brought you, you have to be in a certain frame of mind in order to get a nevuah about something. It has to be in your head already, and then Hashem will send you the message that relates to it. But it already has to be on your mind in order for this to work. So he says, Va'ana, and I, Lada Chachma di Isai vi min kol chaya raza dina gelili. He says, it's not that I am wiser than anybody else, that's such that I should know this. Lahain al dibras di fishra lamalka yehoda un v'rayone libavach tinda. He says, it's not that I am any wiser, rather, it's because there was a desire, meaning from God, for you to know what this means. Ant malka chazei havaisa, you saw, va'alut salem chad sagi, there was a great big statue, right? The word salem, the form, like salem elokim, there was a statue, but a giant statue, chad sagi, great. Samadi Kane Rav, the statue was very large, Vizive Yatir, and its radiance, Ziv, right? Its radiance was great. Ka'em Lakavlah, it stood before you, Vireve Dechil, and it had a frightening appearance. Hud Salma, that statue, Reshe Didahav Tav, its head was of pure gold, or fine gold. Chadohi Udraohi Dichsaf, the chest of it, the arms of it, were made of silver. Me'ohi v'yachasei dinachash, and its inner, its belly, as well as its thighs, were of nechash is nechoshet. Nechoshet is literally copper, although you'll see translations that will render it either as brass or bronze, because in those days you didn't have isolated copper. Copper doesn't occur in nature on its own. It's always alloyed with either tin or nickel. And when it's alloyed with one, it makes brass. With the other, it makes bronze. I always forget which is which. But that's why you'll see Nechoshes as either copper, brass, or bronze. But it purely will be copper. I assume, I don't know if some of you have translations around, it renders it something of some of her. Sorry? You have copper, you have bronze. Okay. That's good. Brass would not really be a Nebuchadnezzar type of a thing. You know, copper and bronze. Okay. Shakohi di Farzel. And then he says, the thighs of this statue are of iron, raglohi, and its legs to its feet, minhein di farzel, uminhein di chasaf, are made up of a mix. Some of them are of iron, and some of them are of clay. So you saw this very large statue, gold, silver, copper, iron, and clay. Now, so far there's nothing particularly frightening about it, I would think, but he isn't done. Chazei havaisa, you saw adi his gezeres even dilavidayin. A stone was chiseled, and it was a stone that was chiseled not by hand. It did not emerge from anyone's hand. Umchas litzalma al raglohi, and it struck the statue on its feet, the legs. The legs made of iron and clay. The hadekes himon, and it crushed them. Beidayin, at that point, daku kachada parzla chaspa nachasha kaspa vidahava, the whole thing was crushed. Vahavu ke'ur min idre kayit, it was like straw from the granary of Kayit. Kayit is Kayits, of the harvesting period. Unasa himon rucha, and then there was a great wind that carried them off. V'chol asar lehishtachach lahon, so they couldn't be found anywhere. Va'avna dimachas letzalma, excuse me, and the stone that struck the statue, havas letur rav, became a great mountain, umalas kol ara, and filled the entire land. So you saw this big statue with all the layers get crushed by a stone that emerged and was thrown not by human hand, but by some other agency. That's the dream. What frightened Nebuchadnezzar about this dream?
So some other country is going to come and bring him down. Even though he's so strong with all the different metals,
yeah.
Some other small things like Bubba or whatever is going to come and crush him.
Well, he is Bubba. But he's
a statue of Nebuchadnezzar.
Is it a statue of Nebuchadnezzar? We aren't told anything about that. Except it's a human form, because it describes legs and so forth.
Is this the one where each level is a different goddess?
Yeah.
Is that you going to say?
Because he had the healthy ego and stuff, and maybe he was recognizing that there is a god, but he's saying it's not, and he's actually full of it.
Right. So there's a lot that we're going to see here. But yes, the idea that each of the materials represents a different stage of history. And the idea is that, in fact, the stone is going to represent the one who's going to bring them all down. And yes, it also involves his fear of God. This idea that there's something that's more powerful than Nebuchadnezzar is, and that's certainly an element of it. Do the layers themselves resonate at all? They ring a bell?
I think it's interesting how the whole thing comes down from the legs. Like, it's like not the head. It's like, and I don't know if it's me, but like it reminds me of 9/11. Just because I was in New York and I was 16, and like, so it was, and then the whole thing sort of just came down by like not, you know,
right,
anything that seems so strong.
I hear that.
Sorry, I'm like
Well, it is the legs, and the question, one of the questions is going to have to be, why is it the legs that get knocked down? But once we see the explanation of the dream, I think the reason for it will be clear. But I think there's another piece here. Gold, silver, copper, and then iron and clay. That's an interesting idea. No, that I hadn't thought of. Is it? Well, we'll see how that fits with the explanations of the dream, and then we'll see. But
it goes from like a higher level to a lower level.
Maybe. Stronger to weaker? Really?
Weaker to stronger.
Weaker to stronger.
Start going the other way, yeah.
That would be an interesting question. I mean, gold has certain properties that give it, you know, not just value, but that make it more useful than silver. So I'm not sure. I wouldn't go with pure strength necessarily. It's an interesting idea. But one piece that you have to mention when you read this, because Tanathu is kind of irresponsible. I don't know if any of you have background in Greek poetry, but I made you a reference here after number six. Hesiod. Hesiod, of the Greek poet, lived in the period 7th to 8th century before the Common Era. And he had a play, or a poem, called Works and Days, which included a section called A Myth of the Ages. And in The Myth of the Ages, he describes the periods of history as the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Heroic Age, and then the Iron Age. That's Hesiod the Greek. Now, if you do the math, you realize he precedes Daniel. He didn't get this from Daniel. So then they ask the question, are you suggesting the opposite? No, not necessarily. The way I think that it could be read, though, is that Nebuchadnezzar is very familiar with this. Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonian king of the far-reaching empire, is very familiar with Hesiod's work, and he knows the play, and that's the image that's sitting in his head.
Aren't the Greeks after them?
The Greeks rise to become the great empire that they become after... But they exist before. Their culture exists before. Their early philosophers are before. Yeah.
And it also could be that Daniel is stressing the fact that he got the interpretation from Hashem. Right? It's another force that no one sees that comes, right? And he asked, I mean, this must have been going on for a while. It didn't just happen in a matter of days. That he's looking, this dream troubled him, and he's looking for some explanation. None of the smartest people in the whole kingdom can give it to him, and then here he comes and says, it's not for me, I'm not smart, God told this to me, and then he's like, oh my God, that's my dream.
Yeah.
And then that's in itself is frightening, regardless of the dream obviously troubles him, but...
Right. Well, he was frightened before.
Nebuchadnezzar believed in God. So before he went to attack Jerusalem, he did all these signs, like he was afraid of...
That's Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you gotta get your Nebus.
But he worked for him.
Nebuchadnezzar is a religious man. It's not ours.
But didn't he at one point, I remember learning, he changed the order of some of the letter that went out.
We're getting there.
He also experienced this to change his thought process. Is this before that happened or after?
Right. So Nebuchadnezzar is a believer in gods. He's not necessarily a believer in our God yet. That's coming. And we will see something that he will get credit for in that regard. So that's true. But yeah, this is a learning process for him. This is his this is where he's finally going to come to understand something. But what I'm suggesting in terms of Hesiod's poem is simply that I think Nebuchadnezzar is familiar with it, and because the book has already stressed, you've said several times in Sefer Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar is thinking about what's going to be in the future. It's when his reign is already great. We talked about it the second year, potentially after he has conquered all these different nations. He's thinking in terms of history and the eras of history that are coming. And so the image is already in his head. And Hashem uses it to convey this image of the future periods that are coming and ultimately where things are going to go in the end with this stone that's going to bring them all down, as we're going to see.
So is it a prophecy for him or for the Jews?
So it's actually for Nebuchadnezzar, rather than for the Jews. I don't think this is even necessarily told to the Jews at this time. Daniel will ultimately record it, and it's going to go into Tanakh, but we get no mention whatsoever of this being a message to the Jews. So take a look at what he says then. Pasuk Lamed Vav, sentence 36. Dinah Chelma, that's the dream, he says. Ufishrei Neymar Kadam Malka. And I'm going to now state the explanation of it in front of the king. And he says, in front of the king, Abarbanel comments, and I brought it for you in number 6, that what he's saying is, this I'd rather tell in private to the king. In other words, the dream I can say in front of everybody. I'm not so sure you want everyone to know about the explanation. So that I'm going to say, Kadam Malka, specifically in front of the king. What is it? Ant Malka Melech Malchaya. Ring a bell? Yeah. That's the one. This is where it comes from. I mean, in general, much of Karibon comes from, Sefer Daniel, just because that's an Aramaic source in Tanakh. So you're going to see it there. There's very little other Aramaic in Tanakh. So don't be surprised when you see that. But he's actually not referring to God. He's referring to Daniel. He's referring to Nebuchadnezzar. Like when you say Antu Malka Melech Malchaya, you're borrowing a phrase that's actually referring to Daniel. To Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah, that's awkward. So, but then you can impress everybody at your shop table.
Yeah, certainly. It'd be like, in Megillat Esther, when it talks about Hashem, or it talks about the king is talking about Hashem, but when it says,
Right, so you'll see the sentence. It doesn't work in the sentence. It would be nice, but it doesn't work. He says, you, king of kings of kings, king of all kings, Dialaka Shemaya Mahusa Chisna Vesakva Vikari Havlach, the God of heaven has given you monarchy, strength, and honor. So Hashem gave this to you, who are Melech Malchayim Lach. So it's clearly Nebuchadnezzar.
Art scroll.
Yeah.
Does a little you, O King, for whom the King of Kings, who is the God of Heaven, has given a strong power and honor. So it keeps it consistent with Karibon.
Interesting. So they'll break between Malka and Melech Malchayim. I mean, the truck doesn't fit that at all. I admit that it's a more comfortable read from a religious perspective. I wouldn't take that as pshat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Daniel is speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, let's not forget.
And it's okay to call him the King of Kings because he was the King of so many
countries. Because he is. Yeah. Okay. Uvachol vidarin b'nei anasha chivas bara va'op shemaya yahav vidach. He says, wherever human beings live, the human beings, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, God has given them all into your hand. V'hash letach b'chol hon. He made you the ruler over all of them. Ant huresha didava. You are the golden head of the statue. Okay. And even the beasts are in your control. I brought you a pasuk from Yirmiyahu in source number 7 just to show you. Yirmiyahu actually foresaw that happening. Daniel is channeling Yirmiyahu. In number 7, Yirmiyahu says, speaking for Hashem, Anochi nasati es kol ha'aratzos ha'ele v'yad Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel avdi. I have given all of these lands into the control of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. And even the beasts of the field. So that's a consistent image. Yirmiyahu says it, and Daniel says it as well. I would hope so. I mean, Yirmiyahu is the Navi from the end of the
face of the Mikdash. And he was still Daniel was before his Galus.
Well, Daniel was there and then went into Galus.
So it was like exactly contemporary?
Yeah, basically. I mean, Yirmiyahu would have been older. But yes, and Yirmiyahu may have gone into Galus and Babel as well. He goes first to Mitzrayim, that whole story. But yeah, I think that will be consistent. He would certainly be familiar with it. Everybody knew Yirmiyahu in the day. I mean, they imprisoned him. They did all sorts of stuff to him. But you couldn't ignore Yirmiyahu. So this image of the animals being in his control is also going to matter a great deal when you get to Perek Dalet. So the image of animals in Nebuchadnezzar is going to matter. So he says, you're the head of gold. So far it probably feels pretty good. Ubasrach, but after you, Tekum Malchu Malchu Achari, there's another king coming. Araminach, he's going to be lower than you. Umalchut Lisa Achari Dinachasha, and there's going to be a third one of Kaper. Tisishlat Bacholara, who will reign over the whole world. Umalchu Rivi'ah, and then a fourth monarchy, Tehave, which will there will also be Takifa Kiparzala, strong as iron. Kol kavel di parzla mahadek v'chashel kola, in the sense that iron is able to crush everything. Ucha parzla di mirah kol ilain tadek v'seirawa. And as iron is able to crush everything, that's what this empire is going to do. So you've got four empires, and then this mixture of iron and clay. V'dichazaisa raglaya v'etzba'asa minhen chasaf di fechar u'minhen parzel. He says, and then you saw the legs, the toes, that some of them were iron and some of them were clay. He says, malchu feliga teheve, there will be a split empire. U'min nitzbisa di farzel leheve va, and it will have elements of the strength of iron in it. As you saw, you will see that they will have iron mixed in with clay. The esbas raglaya, we're in pasuk membet, the toes on the feet, some of them minhein parzel, minhein chasaf, some is iron, some is copper, is clay. Min ktsas malchusa tehevi sakifa, uminat tehevi sivira, because some of it will be very strong and some of it will be fragile, broken. Dichazaisa parzla ma'arav b'chasach tina. You saw iron mixed in with clay. Misarvin lahevon vizra anasha. They will be mixed in among man. Below lahevon dovkin dinan dina. They will not stick together. In other words, it's not one big empire, but rather it's in pieces. It's in components. Hey chidi parzla misala misarav im chaspa. And just like iron doesn't mix well with clay, you can't really have them stick to each other. So that's what it's going to be like. It's really separate empires that are interwoven among each other, but they don't stick. They're not one empire. Okay. Uviyome hona di malchaya, and in the days of those empires, inun of di malchaya inun of these empires, I should say, yikim elaka shmaya malchu. God is going to set up another empire, Dila Omen Lasis Chabal, which will never be destroyed. Umalchusa la Amachron Lasishtavik, and it will never give up its reign into anybody else. Visasev Kol Ilein Malchavasa, it will destroy all of these empires. Vehi Tekumla Omaya, and it will stand forever. Kol Kevel Vichazaisa, as you saw, Dimitura is Gezeres Even, a stone chiseled out of the mountain, Dilavi Dayin, without any human hand, because it's Hashem doing it, Vahadeg is Parzla Nachasha Chaspa Kaspa Vidava, and it destroys everything, and he blends everything together, the iron, the copper, the clay, the silver, the gold. Elaka Rav Hodel Malka, the great God has told this to the king, Madi Lehebe Achre Dina, what's happening next in the world, Vyatsiv Chelma Umehemana Pishrei, and the dream is true, and its interpretation is faithful, meaning this is indeed what is going to happen.
We have five, I can't think of five. Yeah.
Right. So the question is, we do have a concept in Judaism of the four Goliot, the four exiles, and it comes squarely from Daniel. That this is where they're getting it from. But it sounds like there are five. So I give you a table on your sheet. Source number 8 is just Ibn Ezra talking about the idea of them mixing among each other. Ibn Ezra's view is that this is Greece and Rome. So he says the mixing is that when they marry in among each other, but they don't resemble each other, and therefore they're separate empires. But look at the table of who are the four kingdoms. I brought you four different views.
This is before it happens, right? Except for Babylon.
This is before it happens, other than Babel, correct. So Rashi in the Medrash is the classic, which I'm sure is what you heard before. Babel is the gold. Paras u'Madai together are the silver. Paras and Madai are together because Madai doesn't seem to reign independently. There may be one king, Daryavesh the Mede. We have to get to that ultimately in the book. We're not anywhere near there yet. But Paras and Madai go together. Greece is copper. Rome is the iron and the clay. That's the way that Rashi understands it. The iron and clay, all of that is Rome. He's putting them all together. That's correct.
Because later in history, it gets mixed up. Like, we don't consider ourselves under the Romans right now.
Right. It just grouped as a name of Gallus of Rome, and Rome is Christianity, and correct. Interestingly, by the way, I didn't bring it on your sheet, but the church was of the view that the fourth is Rome, and that the stone is the Christian takeover of Rome. Right? In the 4th century, when they take over Rome. Oh, that's what Daniel foresaw. We are the kingdom that is forever, and we took over Rome. And Abarbanel takes 2 pages of dense text to completely demolish the argument. He says, first of all, each of these in the statue, they're all independent, discrete nations. They're not a religion that, takes over one. It's a nation with a land. The second, he says, what do you do with the separate iron and pottery that's within Rome? He says that doesn't fit. In general, Abarbanel does not like the idea that Rome is the iron and clay, as we'll see. He says, but more, the fifth one is supposed to be forever. Well, Christianity has been adopted and then rejected by some nations. Some of them, in his day, have gone over to Islam. So he says, it's not forever. Therefore, that can't be what the dream was. And he also notes that chronologically it doesn't work because Rome takes over Greece at about the same time that Christianity begins its ascension. So it wouldn't have a standalone that's then knocked out by the church. I'm not sure I agree with him on the history piece of it. But in any case, that's the church's take on it. But Rashi's take is the one that I think we're generally familiar with, doesn't really address the question of iron and clay. Rav Sadia Gaon, as well as Abarbanel, have a different take. And they suggest that Babel is the one that's gold, Madai and Paras are the silver, Greece is indeed the copper, and the iron and clay is because you have Rome versus Yishmael, and it's really Rome becoming Christian, and then Yishmael taking on Islam. And that's what it is, because they're interspersed among each other. They don't blend with each other. And that's what they see. It's a particularly important vision for Abarbanel, because remember that he is living the end of the 15th century, the period when the Christians, primarily through Spain, have managed to reconquer much of the land that had been taken by the Muslims. That's why they kicked out the Jews. Right? In 1492, when Ferdinand and Isabella exiled the Jews, when they expelled the Jews, it's part of a celebration of thanks to their God that they have managed to defeat the Muslims. And they feel like now that we've defeated the Muslims and reunited Spain under Christian control, now is our opportunity to thank their God by kicking out the Jews too.
They also don't get to wage war anymore.
Right, they also, they're safer than they were, and they don't therefore need the Jews, and so forth. Yes. So that's another school of thought, is that he's saying, you think that you've done away with the Muslims, but actually the Jews are coming and they're going to do away with both of you. And so that's another take. Ibn Ezra disagrees on the identity of the iron and clay, and he says it's Yishmael primarily and the remaining kings of Rome. And then there's another view, which I think is very important, and that's the view of Rav Yaakov Meidan, who is a rabbi in Israel today. And he says, I don't think that you necessarily need to read this as ending with Mashiach. He argues that, and this is going to fit with other elements of the Sefer later on, towards the end of the Sefer, that actually this stone could be the Hashmonaim. Because there is this idea that the Hashmonaim had the potential to be Mashiach, but they went bad. We know that after the initial generation of the Hashmonaim, as Ramban writes, things go sour because they take the monarchy for themselves instead of leaving it for Yehuda, and they're Kohen and they're not supposed to do it. They start to emulate the ways of the Greeks. So things go bad. But what Daniel is envisioning is, in fact, you see the last line of the table, Babel, Parasumadai, Greece under Alexander the Great is the copper. After Alexander dies, the empire splits. You have a whole bunch of different princes, right? You have the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and there's a third. Seleucids, Ptolemies, and there's a third one I'm blanking.
The one that's like actually... Seleucids is like Syria, Ptolemaic is like Egypt.
Right.
And the one that's like...
And then the other one.
Greece.
Yeah. Don't remember. Okay. So, but then you have, after the three, then you have a whole bunch of princes. And and that's the iron and the clay, all these princes who have taken over, and then the Hashmonaim coming along to battle them are in fact the stone. Now you pointed out that the stone knocks out the iron and clay, that's because the other ones are already gone. In other words, this is now a later moment in history. Babel, Parasim, Madai, they're all gone at this point, and it's only the iron and clay that remains, but in knocking them out, you're knocking out all of the previous ones. You follow? So that's the dream, and that's the explanation, and that shows why Nebuchadnezzar is going to be so upset by this dream.
Was he not worried over the interpretation?
So he says it to him, he says it very respectfully. I guess it's a Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore he has no choice. He sort of has to say it, but we'll see what Nebuchadnezzar does in response. Both in response to Daniel and in response to the dream. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
So when Daniel's plan is over, though, he doesn't necessarily know that the kingdoms are coming. He just knows there are four kingdoms, right?
Because
he's before.
Well, does the Nebuchadnezzar, how much does Hashem disclose to him in terms of the identity of them? No idea. Doesn't say, there's no indication within the
Sefer. Represents
correct. Right.
Is this considered Edom?
So Edom would be Rome, yeah.
Nebuchadnezzar is nervous because this new tunnel is going to come and take over him, or could just be in the future, like maybe the kingdom above him.
Right. Oh, he's not nervous. Nebuchadnezzar is offended. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar believes that, yes, Babel forever.
He asked for it.
He did ask for it, yes. But Nebuchadnezzar is offended, not by Daniel, he's offended by God. Like, how dare you? Babel is going to reign forever. That's his vision of it. And you'll see what he's going to do to counter this, because that's what's coming. Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a counter move, because inevitably, the villains in Tanakh, when they find out what's coming, like when Hashem tells them, they don't usually use it as an opportunity for tshuva. That's not really where they go. Then that's why they're the villains. So what we'll have to see is what comes next, the response immediately to Daniel, and then the response to the dream as a whole.